This is Get Lit With Literature. This is Monk. There's more at allbook-books.com. Jonathan Crary's Scorched Earth, Beyond the Digital Age to a Post-Capitalist World by Verso. Very thought-provoking book. And trying to wrap it up here. Don't know if I can, but we'll see. Anyway, iris scanning is another technology often aligned in the same devices with eye tracking. Someone I mentioned this to said they think their Apple phone has the eye tracking, so I guess it can test your wares as you wear. And then he's got some phrases here that I just thought were beautifully poetic. For thousands of years in many different cultures, the iris was the presence in the body of a flickering chromatic vivacity akin to natural phenomena such as rainbows or flowers. However, unlike the fleeting occurrence of a rainbow or the transience of flowers, the iris persists in the body for a lifetime. A shared gaze always holds the promise of a glimpse of iridescence, whether between friends, lovers, or strangers. It has a rhythmic response to the illumination or darkening of the world. Amid the fluctuations of light, the appearance of the iris, its aqueous translucence, modulates and resists chromatic stabilization. How often have we noticed of someone we know well that the color of their eyes shifts in different light? A wonder of the iris is that for an observer it is never identical to itself. Its colors are not static and thus unpossessible. Contemplation of the other's eyes opens onto both its cherished familiarity and its enigmatic beauty. Enigmatic beauty is something getting lost with all the technology. Touches upon what indigenous native peoples would call all our relations. Writing in the 1950s, when positive assumptions about the study of nature went mostly unquestioned, Portman sought a holistic understanding of the sensory interconnectedness of an animate earth. At the same time, he was one of a few deploring the spread of visual illiteracy brought on by reproductive media such as National Geographic and TV wildlife shows, and exclusively urban lifestyles resulting in remoteness from a non-human life world. Since then, the estrangement of our senses from the world has been immeasurably heightened by the pervasiveness of computer-generated images of all kinds. Now, for example, we can easily access magnified ultra-high-resolution images of irises which reveal countless details unseen in a direct meeting. Yet for most viewers, these become unremarkable curiosities drained of anything experienced in lived interpersonal proximity. And he gets into what the eye tracking does. One particular capability of eye tracking is the collection of data on what colors and combinations of colors and graphics are most or least eye-catching. Research on color and behavior, especially in relation to advertising, is hardly new, but what has changed is our 24/7 engagement with the chromatic environment of screens and displays. The ubiquity of electroluminescence has crippled our ability or even motivation to see in any close or sustained way the colors of physical reality. Even at the gas station, there are screens. For me, that's not just visual, that's just a few moments of quiet. Color is continuous with our tactile sensitivity to inflections in the air, to sounds, odors, and to a bold bodily awareness that birds, animals, and vegetation are likewise attuned to this daily event. That's another thing I've read about with all the cell towers and this and that, how it's affecting bird navigation and this and that. And also, I'll add, with the estrangement from our senses, a lot of it's just become commodified. I mean, now we've got, scented candles of every imaginable smell and scent. And all the little yard lights that, I bought one a long time ago. The solar light, you can stick it in the ground and, wow, there's a light. But, I don't know, it just didn't do that a while ago. Now, all of a sudden, it's like everybody's got a fascinated with these extra lights. It's after a while it becomes quite annoying. And here's a bit of, again, he ties in the history. The invention of artificial colors in the mid-19th century had far-reaching consequences. It's no coincidence that the large-scale manufacture of highly profitable synthetic dyes in the 1860s brought into being the chemical conglomerates from IG Farben, who has a horrendous track record with the Nazis, IG Farben and BASF to Dow, DuPont, and Sinopec that have been damaging and obliterating life on the planet for the last 100 years. The industrialization of color is historically intertwined with the making of plastics, herbicides, pesticides, PCBs, polyvinyl chloride, and innumerable other compounds that have poisoned our water, air, soils, and oceans. Driven by the expansion of commodity production and the rise of mass consumption, the proliferation of manufactured color is part of a larger relocation of sensory experience into the needs and values of a capitalist economy. Mass consumption, the proliferation of manufactured color, part of a larger relocation of sensory experience. Synthetic color becomes allied with techniques of attraction, solicitation, and persuasion. Writing around 1900, the sociologist George Simmel observed that when nothing is exempt from being monetized or exchangeable, we are condemned to a world drained of color, stripped of the fabric woven from all the moments of heightened life and quiet elation that are born most often in mutuality and intimacy. As David Abram and others have warned, we've lost our bodily understanding of the world and its rhythms and no longer have a kinesthetic immersion in living environments. Now, I've heard this on First Voices Radio, because of the Native Indigenous deep relationship with the land, that the less that the land is, that even though one may have the traditions and the rituals and this and that, but the land is the key there, and also for all the two-leggeds, four-leggeds, and other beings. We may abstractly deplore the millions of lives and species rendered disposable by capitalism or the devastation of ecosystems on which we depend, but we cling to our disembodied online routines and to the illusion that the internet complex is somehow not a primary agent of the catastrophe. So there's where he really points the finger at the internet and is not just, how do we use the technology wisely? It's like, how do we deal with this in the big picture? Claim the reassuring fiction of, quote, our, unquote, internet that in fact never existed. And here's an IT cybersecurity firm promotes its product as follows. Now, this speaks volumes to the people on edge and paranoid. The new threatscape, there's a portmanteau. The new threatscape we all inhabit requires zero trust. Zero trust security assumes that bad actors already exist both inside and outside the network. Trust must therefore be entirely removed from the equation. So this gets into what I've been thinking about for a while, the sense of, you know, everything online with a PIN number and, all these checkpoints where it's secure and you've scanned it and everything's hunky-dory and everything seems all right. But here's the thing. The more the technology, the less we, as a people, what I'm trying to say is, like, if you're with someone in person, now what is one of the ultimate tests to see if this person is genuine or, putting on a con or just troubled or whatever, is the look them in the eye. Him or her in the eye, or the energy that one puts out. So that to me seems like, I think about that some kind of futuristic way sometimes, like without so much technology, if people are forced to then deal with people, look them in the eye and see if this person's, you know, genuine or what, are people going to have the ability to do that when they've been programmed to just, you know, click safe or click unsafe? In another level of the facial recognition, emotion recognition technology. One company offers software for, quote, seamless data collection, synchronization, visualization, and analysis in combination with other sensors and technologies such as eye tracking, galvanic skin response, EEG, facial expression analysis, and much more in one single computer system. One of the aims is to determine the emotional state of someone under observation, often through categories of happiness, sadness, surprise, anger, fear, disgust, and contempt, and dozens of secondary expressions. corporations with names like Effectiva, Emotient, and Beyond Verbal are developing forms of facial coding or emotion AI to analyze facial expressions in real time. In other words, in the words of one company's promotions, we now have a powerful way to understand consumers' unfiltered responses by measuring moment-by-moment reactions to digital and video ads. So this, not only do those companies sound like those could easily be companies for the new, you know, drugs that come out. Effectiva, Emotient, Beyond Verbal. So there's an interesting verbal insanity that's happening when the corporations and the drugs sound the same, because basically those two are the same. But to my understanding, measuring moment by moment reactions to digital video, so this whole science, this is what, for me personally, I worked on for decades of training myself to be observant and vigilant and notice, you know, things that change. When I built a Zen garden and put sand in the patio and just watched it, it was like a week later, I noticed a twig where there had been nothing. So that, to me, that's the kind of the training of that's been, you know, around for millennia, that people were outside more and they just had to observe their natural environment. But now, when all the energy and the attention and the technology and the money goes to this advertising mode of hyper vigilance in a, you know, marketing consumer sense, I think that things are going off the rails in that sense. There is software capable of detecting all kinds of smiles, especially to indicate when a minimum, quote, smile threshold, end quote, is triggered by stimuli or various kinds. This computational scrutiny of the face can also interpret micro expressions such as the flickers of involuntary motor activity that, for example, might conceal the expression of emotion or stimulate an emotion we do not feel. There are scanners for detecting asymmetrical facial expressions such as slight traces of smirks or grimaces. In the words of one robotics company, the goal is to, quote, infuse them with emotional intelligence and make them truly social. So again, there's this overriding of actually being emotionally intelligent and actually being truly social and transferring it onto the robotics. Now, that's one I would like to ask a psychiatrist or about, like this transference onto the technology rather than in the actuality. As modern notions of individuality emerged, especially in the 17th century, the face, with all its expressive possibilities, required self-mastery and control. So here he goes into the history. Beginning in court society, individuals learned what facial expressions were appropriate to specific social situations and what was permissible in private and more intimate settings. So that's I found that interesting, because this court scene in the 1700s, this whole sense of social, you know, put on a good face, that whole thing. Now it's becoming, you know, technology, put on the good face. And neurosciences, social media, AI capabilities, it's all combining for what I would call another huge irony in the world, as there seem to be huge ironies nowadays, that this hypervigilance to the microsecond of the, quote, consumer, aka human beings, facial expressions, contrasted by the faceless corporations. You don't ever see who runs the place. You can barely talk. If you call up on a phone, you can barely talk to the ones in charge. So again, I say, like with the surveillance, that there's no surveillance. We don't see the daily surveillance of the horror and the atrocities of the genocide in Gaza or Ukraine or wherever else. But we are being watched so that we don't steal, you know, a candy bar at the checkout counter. And similarly, what the F these corporations and people are doing to manipulate all this stuff. We don't get to see that, but the people's faces and micro this and that get studied. So it's this very flipped. It's a flipped world. I have this phrase from a poem a long time ago about TV. I called it the ever-polished milieu. And here he describes pretty much that. There is a long history of the face as image, whether of Christ, of whiteness, of the monarch or tyrant. By the early 20th century, the despotism of the face had been assimilated into dominant forms of spectacle and celebrity culture. But within this oppressive continuum of face as image, the living face of the suffering, the destitute, or the non-white is consistently erased. Again, he quotes to promote, you know, one of the ways we can, as a people, can overcome this over-mechanized stuff. The actuality of meeting, that occasional dialogue or held forth, is its possibility. Dialogue was crucial to the building of sustaining of living together as a community. And then he mentions the Paris Commune, workers' cooperatives, and the early kibbutzim. Working and being together required from everyone a level of shared responsibility, but this could only occur meaningfully as a response to what one, in italics, faces, what faces one in a living situation. Every living situation has a new face that has never been and will never come again. And he mentions living reciprocal relationships. Again, this is something I've heard from native peoples, the reciprocity with the natural world, living reciprocal relationships. But throughout history, the depersonalized it world had been mitigated by communal forms of life in which caring, mutual support, and festivity were valued and sustained. Yet technological modernity, he feared, was so encroaching on those fears that the, quote, interhuman is threatened in its very existence. And here's a wonderful phrase I like, a sudden awakening, the epiphanic force of the commonplace. Epiphanic force of the commonplace. That's a good description of haiku poetry. You're finding the extraordinary in the ordinary. The epiphanic force of the commonplace. Pointing to how the face is exploited and debased in advertising, pornography, and many other domains, he writes that face is the object of, quote, a global civil war whose battlefield is social life in its entirety, whose victims are all the peoples of the earth. That was some guy named Agamben. So he does highlight the social. Towards the end of the book, Crary highlights the war on the sociability, the socialness. So that's one aspect of the technology along with the earth, scorched earth. And we repeatedly are told that machines are becoming more human, an absurd, fatuous claim because it presupposes a neoliberal corporatist notion of what, quote, human is. Again, it's like, why do we need to make machines more human? How do we encourage people, you know, being human? And again, the reminder that, you know, this social media is overseen by the corporations. So it's, again, this contrast of the corporate and the technology that is literally flavoring the social scene and the way we, not just the social scene online, but the social behaviors and the people growing up with this stuff is affecting their way of being social or asocial. So there's only about 6 pages left, but I have a lot underlined, asterisks, and since it's the closing chapter, looks like gonna go another part 7. We'll do it. Thanks for listening, and be well.